From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Christian men's movement, the Promise Keepers, emphasizes making and keeping commitments to God and family. The group's founder, Bill McCartney, has written a new memoir in which he confesses to having neglected his own family because he was so absorbed in his work and his religion. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk about this paradox with Bill McCartney and his wife, Lindy McCartney, and we'll discuss some of the controversies surrounding the Promise Keepers. Also, we talk with jazz composer Steve Lacy, who is considered the father of the modern soprano saxophone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. U.S. officials are expressing optimism that the standoff between the United Nations and Iraq could soon be over. Iraq, after talking with Russian officials, says it will readmit U.N. weapons inspectors without condition and allow them to go on with their work. National Security Advisor Sandy Berger warns that whatever agreement Russia cut with Iraq, the United States is not bound by it.
This is not over. We have to maintain the two-pronged strategy we've been pursuing. The diplomatic effort to resolve this on a peaceful and principled basis, backed by a strong military presence in the region to keep our options open.
Iraq's deputy prime minister says no deals were made to readmit the UN weapons inspectors, but he admits that Baghdad sought Russian help in the face-off. Dale Gavlak reports from Cairo.
Iraq's deputy prime minister Tariq Aziz said Russia promised to work with the other permanent members of the UN Security Council to create balance on the UN Special Commission on Weapons Inspections in Iraq.
I did not make a deal in Moscow. As I said, both in Arabic and in English, I said that the Russian Federation showed understanding to the legitimate concerns and grievances of Iraq.
Aziz said Russia affirmed it would do all it could to start a new UN approach towards Iraq so that trade sanctions may finally be lifted. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
This just in, the United States says it will send 32 additional warplanes, including fighter jets and B-1 bombers, to the Gulf region near Iraq. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has punished his top economic aide by stripping him of one of his two government posts. From Moscow, NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Anatoly Chubais has been leading Russia's push toward a market economy from two powerful positions, first deputy prime minister and finance minister. But Chubais has been caught in a scandal that saw three of his close allies fired over the weekend. They and Chubais allegedly accepted a huge book advance from a company that benefited from Chubais's policies. Communist leaders in parliament have been demanding Chubais's resignation since the scandal broke, but President Yeltsin said he would not give in. Now, however, Itar Tass reports Yeltsin has stripped Chubais of his finance ministry post while letting him remain in the higher deputy prime minister job. If this satisfies critics, Chubais's position should still allow him to steer economic reforms. His replacement in the finance post is a fellow economic liberal, Mikhail Zadornov, whose presence should reassure Western governments that reforms will continue. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 75 points at 7,799. The Nasdaq is up more than 18 at 1,619. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher for the fifth time in six sessions. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market is being boosted by a drop in long-term interest rates, which are lower following an unexpectedly weak reading on regional manufacturing in the Philadelphia area. Also arguing in favor of lower rates is a drop in crude oil. That's occurred after Iraq succumbed to pressure from the UN and agreed to allow a weapons inspection team back in the country. The market's rise is being led by drug stocks. Shares in Eli Lilly are higher on expectations the company will win FDA approval for its drug to prevent osteoporosis in postmenopausal women. I'm Doug Krisner.
Raytheon says it may have to close 12 plants and parts of eight others to keep a promise to cut costs by 10%. The promise was made after the defense contractor bought two other rivals. A Raytheon spokesman would not say which plants might be targeted for closing. Raytheon shareholders must still approve the purchase of Hughes Electronics, a former subsidiary of General Motors. The cutbacks could increase the company's stock price, which has fallen slightly this week. Raytheon's defense sector has about 35 plants, mostly located in Massachusetts and Texas. It employs some 81,000 people. Waste services company Safety-Kleen says it has agreed to be bought by a new company being formed by Canadian firm Phillips Services and two investors. The deal beats an earlier bid by Laidlaw Environmental Services, which is also two-thirds owned by a Canadian company. Safety-Kleen will go on operating with its own name. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach, with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It was just a few weeks ago that the Promise Keepers held a large gathering in the nation's capital, calling on its members to make and keep promises to God and family. Now the founder of the group, Bill McCartney, who is also the former head football coach for the University of Colorado, has a new memoir about his failures within his own family. Passages are written by his wife of 35 years, Lindy McCartney, who says, "I felt like his 100% devotion to his religion and his career left nothing for me." In 1993, she felt so neglected she fell into a paralyzing depression. That same year, their daughter Christy gave birth to a child fathered out of wedlock by a player on the team Bill coached. Christy already had a child fathered by a different player on Bill McCartney's team. In 1994, Bill McCartney left his coaching career to devote more time to his family and to the Promise Keepers, which he founded in 1991. I spoke to Bill and Lindy McCartney. Bill said that when he started the Promise Keepers, he didn't understand the structure of marriage the way God intended it.
Well, I was a guy that had a heart for God, was involved in a very challenging career in coaching, and so I was really in pursuit of the Lord, but I was also taking on all challengers in coaching, and lost in all of that was my marriage and my responsibilities at home, and I didn't really see it as clearly as I do now. As a matter of fact, I would tell people that my priorities are the Lord first, my family, my marriage second, and my career third. But the truth of it is that football took so much time and required so much a focus that it was probably first in reality. But Promise Keepers helped me see that and do something about it.
Lindy McCartney, I'd like you to describe in your words the central paradox that you faced in your family as Bill McCartney, your husband, formed the Promise Keepers.
Well, I really thought quite highly of my husband. I was very proud of him and the good I saw him doing out there in the world, I wanted him to do at home.
In the book, you say that even a couple of years into the Promise Keepers, Lindy McCartney, that you were just in this terrible depression. You lost 80 pounds. You didn't leave her your room. You were in a terrible depression. How did that depression connect to your husband's work with the Promise Keepers?
Again, a longing in my heart just be connected with my husband, and I just saw him finding even more things to be busy with and focused on and leaning towards. And now, you know, you have that element of the Lord, which makes it even better than the element of helping young men. Serving the Lord is a very high calling. It's a tremendous honor. But so when a wife kind of gets angry at her husband, when he's serving the Lord, then the wife feels very guilty because he's out there doing an incredibly wonderful thing. So I was suffering from that, you know, feeling guilty for being angry at this great thing that he was doing.
Well, Bill McCartney, if you spent so little time with your own family, why was the idea of the Promise Keepers so important to you? The idea of a spiritual calling to the family, to spend more time with the family. I mean, so much of the Promise Keepers emphasizes family. So why was that your emphasis?
Well, first of all, there are many times when I was home, but the lights weren't on. I was preoccupied. I was thinking about the next football game or whatever. And then secondly, you need to understand that when Promise Keepers was birthed, that wasn't the main thrust that came out of it. And as it did, I was a guy and am a guy who prayed daily over his wife early in the morning, prayed God's blessings over her and spent time reading scripture with her. And so those things were in order. But what I realized and what Promise Keepers helped me realize is that I was a taker and not a giver. And it was about the things that I dreamt about doing. It was, our life had revolved around the gifts that I had, and Lindy was left to tag along. And then as I was confronting these things, I realized Lindy has tremendous gifts, but they're not coming to bear in our relationship and in our marriage because we're just in pursuit of the things that I enjoy doing, that I've always dreamt of doing. And as that was unfolding, you need to understand also that I wasn't in the stadiums preaching about marriages. I was in the stadium, but there were other guys that were bringing that message. And I was sharing with men to be wholehearted before the Lord. And I was sharing what it means as a man of God to be in pursuit of the heart of God, which I was doing.
But it does seem from the way you've each described it that you were pursuing the heart of God in a very egotistical and self-serving way. You know, that a lot of your work, it seems in retrospect, was really about self-gratification and ego, you know, to the exemption of your family.
Well, I think it would be if you could clearly see the contradiction and then did nothing about it but just to exalt yourself. But that was not my heart. And what happened to me was a visiting preacher came in our church and brought a message. And when he brought this message, it really confronted me. And he essentially said this. He said, "You want to know about the character of a man? All you need to do is look into his wife's countenance, and everything that he's invested or withheld will be in her face." And I looked at Lindy, and I didn't see radiance or splendor. I saw frustration, and I saw anguish. And from that moment forward, I was then confronted with the truth. But I hadn't seen it clearly prior to that. And it was really a result of that message that caused me to rethink my career and to reexamine my motives.
Lindy McCartney, now that your husband feels like he understands better the role of a father and husband in a family, what's changed in your house?
The time we spend together is very valuable. It's very, it's fun. We have a great time together. We have great relationship together now, as opposed to maybe further in the past. One of the things he does that just really pleases me is listens to me. He doesn't cut me off in conversation or dismiss what I say.
But he used to, is what you're saying, but he doesn't anymore.
Oftentimes that busy mind would be full of things, and he wasn't really listening in the first place, and he didn't understand that he was cutting me off mid-sentence sometimes.
My guests are Bill McCartney, founder of The Promise Keepers, and his wife, Lindy McCartney. They've collaborated on a new book called Sold Out. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bill McCartney, founder of The Promise Keepers, and his wife of 35 years, Lindy McCartney. One of the controversies around your group, The Promise Keepers, is whether or not the group really has a political agenda, and if so, is that political agenda a very conservative agenda? Do you want to speak to that question now? You've said that the group doesn't come with a political agenda.
Yeah, and furthermore, there's no evidence that there ever has been one, and because there hasn't been. And see, almost all of these events are on radio, and many of them are on national radio, and certainly they're accessible to anybody who wants to participate. You can go back and get every event that's ever been held, and you can study the content, and there are no political statements. I mean, there's no political motive. And so it's just fear born out of the fact that men have been inconsistent and irresponsible, and so people are fearful of what they might try to accomplish, but there's no motive like that. We just, you have to understand one thing, okay? We believe the Bible is God's blueprint for man. And so when you talk about something, how do you have a good marriage? Rather than listen to somebody's opinion, we say, what does the Bible have to say about it?
Bill McCartney, you've said that your group, The Promise Keepers, doesn't have a political agenda. You, however, in your own life, have had strong political stance that you've made. For example, you've opposed gay rights, and you've denounced, this is a quote from Time magazine, they quoted you as saying that gays have internal upheavals that literally drive a person stark raving mad. That torment makes them the most miserable of all people. And you've said that homosexuality is an abomination of Almighty God.
Yeah, and you know, you have to understand that I'm a sinner, and it's only the grace of mercy of God that has forgiven me. And I believe that the Bible clearly states that homosexuality is a sin. And so, and it says in the Bible that it's an abomination to Almighty God. And so what I did was I quoted Scripture. And so I'm pretty safe in doing that. And now, but I don't have never intended to come off as somebody who is better than somebody else, because I have sin in my own life. And that book that I've written with Lindy is clear that I'm not trying to dodge the fact that my life has been full of mistakes. And so, but I'm out to tell every homosexual and everybody that's had an abortion, because the Bible speaks against abortion, is I'm here to tell them that there's a God who loves us and forgives us. We only need to turn to Him, and that's what I've discovered in my life, and that's why I wrote a book.
You've been quoted as saying, the only way God can be worshipped is through Jesus Christ. There is no other way.
Yeah, those are Jesus' own words. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. There is no way to the Father except through me. I have found in my own life that when I was 33 years old, and I believed in God, and I believed in Jesus Christ, but my life didn't have any power in it. And then I invited Jesus Christ in to my heart, and I was born again of the Spirit of God, and my life has changed. I began find the power to say yes and no to the right and wrong things. And I want to share that with anyone who will listen. And by and large, those guys that fill those stadiums and those guys that went to the mall in D.C., we've had that experience in our lives. And so naturally we would want to share it with someone else. Does that exclude other religions? We don't talk other religions down, but anyone, we do believe in our hearts that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that God so loved the world that he sent his own Son to die for our sins. We believe that passionately, and so that's why we get together like we do, because we have a common faith.
So I just want you to speak to this. The group has no, your group, the Promise Keepers, you say, has no political agenda. But you, on the other hand, you know, are strongly anti-gay, anti-abortion, and feel that the only way God can be worshipped is through Jesus Christ. So are these messages that you're keeping out of the Promise Keepers that you just consider to be personal beliefs, or are these kind of implicit in the Promise Keepers' philosophy?
Well, certainly, as far as Jesus Christ is concerned, it's been very clearly stated that we believe that for a guy to be comfortable in that setting, he has to love Jesus Christ and be born again of the Spirit of God. As far as these issues are concerned, which you call political, these are issues that are in the Bible. And so when they come up, we don't dodge them, but we don't focus on them. We don't draw attention to them in our venues. We want to talk about how we can all come out of sin and come into a right relationship with Jesus Christ.
Bill McCartney, are you concerned at all that some men might pick up a message of intolerance from your own thoughts about people of other faiths or of no faith or against people who are gay or intolerance of women who've had abortions?
No, I think what they'll pick up is they'll discover that what we have is an authentic, genuine desire to love one another, and that is what will attract them to the truth, and that the truth is only found in Jesus Christ. You're not going to find solutions to your problems outside the person of Jesus Christ. The reason for that is God made us for himself. He created mankind to be in fellowship, in relationship with him. Jesus came because man has a sin nature, and he died for those sins. And so I believe sincerely, wholeheartedly, that we have the answer to man's problems, and it's found in the person of Jesus Christ. And so we realize that we did nothing, any of us did nothing to qualify. It's just the mercy of God.
Bill McCartney, you yourself have said that it's only in, I don't know what, the past 3, maybe 4 years that you've come to realize that even when you were home, you were kind of not paying attention to your family, that you were so absorbed in your work and in your religion that you weren't even paying attention to your wife and children. And you say that that's changed in the past few years with the help of the Promise Keepers, but the Promise Keepers were already in effect for a few years before this realization registered on you. A very cynical person could say that perhaps part of the reason why you're paying more attention to your family now and making such a kind of public show of that, public display of it with your new book and the book tour, is that that too has become a part of your work, a part of your public image. And so to, for the sake of your work, for the sake of the Promise Keepers and your image, you have to have the image of a good family life. This is what a really cynical person could say.
Well, but the evidence will really be in the fruit. And if my wife, Lindy, would not testify to the validity of our marriage, then you would be exactly right. Because certainly no woman is going to compromise anything if a man is unjustly behaving in his home. And so she has seen a change that pleases her, that every woman is looking for. In my book, if you've read it, you know that it doesn't present me as a saint. It presents me as a guy who's made many mistakes, came into a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and is becoming a man who can make a difference. In other words, here's a guy that God has used, amongst others, to attract perhaps more than 1 million men to the mall in D.C. And now you say, what is it about this guy? Well, I'm writing a book to tell you there isn't anything about the guy. It's about the God.
Lindsay McCartney, what would you say to a cynic who said, well, sure, your husband is doing more at home now and writing a book about it is part of his public image that he needs to continue the work with the Promise Keepers. What would you say to that cynic?
Get a life. that just, you know, it's really hard for me, Terry. I guess just even to encounter a cynic, that's very difficult for me because a cynic is a person who refuses to see and refuses to hear. And if you refuse to see or refuse to hear, then what can I say? That has to come into that person's heart. There has to be a longing in that person's heart.
Bill McCartney, what's next for the Promise Keepers?
Well, we've targeted January 1st, the year 2000, where we would like to see every church that names the name of Jesus stand up and be counted in three areas. One is that they have vibrant men's ministry. In other words, the men that worship there are actively involved in that church, giving away their time, treasure, and talents. And then secondly, we're calling each church to be connected across the communities so that the poor are being clothed and fed and nurtured and attended to, that there's jobs available to the oppressed and the disadvantaged, and that the needs of those communities are being met through the men in the churches. And then lastly, we're calling each church to stand up and say that racism is dead inside our church. We practice intentional reconciliation. And then also, there's been a big problem in the Christian churches where different denominations have looked down on others, and we've called the churches to put that to rest and to recognize that we're all the same before a holy God. We're sinners saved by grace.
We're all the same, meaning Christians are all the same. What about people who aren't Christians?
Well, hopefully our outreach and how God would use this would influence those that haven't yet subscribed to the tenets of Jesus Christ, that he is the answer. He is the only way to the Father. And they would see that by our fruit, and then they would want some of that so that they can be saved. Because the Bible's clear that without a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, you'll be lost forever. And the consequences are eternal.
Are you saying that you'd like Jews and Muslims and Buddhists to be inspired by your message and convert to Christianity?
Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Bill McCartney is the founder of the Promise Keepers. He and his wife, Lindy McCartney, collaborated on the new book, Sold Out. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and Rising Tide Entertainment, featuring the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's new release, The Christmas Album, available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, composer Steve Lacy on bringing the soprano saxophone into modern jazz. Lacy started his career playing a hybrid of modern jazz and Dixieland, then played with two of the greatest innovators in jazz, Cecil Taylor and Thelonious Monk. Lacy has lived in Paris for many years. He's currently on an American tour. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Steve Lacy brought the soprano saxophone into modern jazz and, in the estimation of many critics, is the best soprano player in jazz. Early in his career, he apprenticed with jazz traditionalists and avant-gardists. Since the mid-60s, he's lived mainly in Europe. He's currently on an American tour. Before we meet him, let's hear one of his compositions featured on his recent CD, Baya. This is called The Hoot. Soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy from his latest trio album, Baya. Steve Lacy, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
I want to start by talking with you about the qualities of your instrument, the soprano saxophone. How would you compare the soprano with the tenor or alto?
Well, of course, it's higher up, and it's smaller, and it's more to the brain, really.
To the brain. What does
this
mean?
At the head of things, it's the, in the treble clef. It's not down below in the chest. It's up in the head, really. It's like a soprano singer, really, compared to a tenor singer.
Now, you came at the soprano after having played clarinet first. A lot of musicians come to soprano after playing another form of saxophone. Mm-hmm. Do you think coming at it from clarinet affected your approach to soprano?
Well, I really came out of the piano. I played the piano when I was a kid, very poorly, but with interest, especially mm-hmm. when I discovered jazz. I try to play jazz on it, and I play it foolishly myself still, but not in public. So the piano is really very important to me. It's at the center of my musical thinking. But the soprano sax is my working voice, really.
You've said that certain parts of the soprano's range are inherently out of tune with the rest of the horn. What part of the range is that, and why is that so?
Well, there are notes here that are too flat and others that are too sharp. It's a little bit, maybe because it's conical rather than cylindrical. And it's sort of a bastard instrument in a way. That it needs to be doctored, personally. You have to really favor certain, but I mean, this is true of a lot of instruments, really. Alto also has funny regions that you have to favor, that you have to, push up, push down, and compensate for the inherent difficulties in the instrument itself.
Does this mean that you need to have a really good ear for pitch in order to play the soprano? And did you have to work hard to develop your ear?
You have to suffer. Or I had to suffer, really, some really hard periods where it was really out of tune, where I just couldn't fix it, really. This was years and years ago, in the 50s, when I was struggling with the instrument. It was very difficult at that time to get it in tune. And now, after all these years, it's much easier, but I have to watch it all the time.
Well, how's your sense of pitch? Do you have perfect pitch?
No, I have a relative pitch, but I have a perfect internal pitch, so I can compose music from inside, but I don't have perfect pitch at all.
Now, the soprano has a naturally nasal and shrill sound in its highest notes. Is that something that you feel like you fight against or try to exploit?
It doesn't have that at all, really. It doesn't mm-hmm. need to have that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just poor playing, you know. Even John Coltrane, when he first played the instrument, he had trouble up there, and it came out nasal and all that. But after a while, it opened up. It's just like your nose, really. If you breathe through your nose, it's all about breathing, really, and it's also about conception. And when you have experience of the horn, it opens up, and it doesn't have to be nasal there at all. But that's one of the reasons I don't play the other saxophones, because I really want to just
be faithful to that one, really.
What was your role in inspiring John Coltrane to try soprano saxophone?
Well, I was sort of the model. In other words, he heard me play it, and he thought it was like he was shopping, and I was modeling. he heard me with, I was playing with Jimmy Giuffre at the Five Spot, and he came in and he heard me play, and he was intrigued by the instrument, and he asked me what key it was in, and when I told him it was B-flat, he said, oh, yeah? And then a couple of weeks later, Don Cherry called me from Chicago, and he said, listen to this, and he held the telephone up, and I could hear Train playing the soprano.
What'd you think of what you first heard of his?
Well, I had a laugh, really. But, wow. I thought, wow, it's nice to have some company.
You're not saying what you thought of the playing.
I mean, it sounded intriguing to me. I liked it, really. It sounded good. I mean, you know, if Don Cherry calls you up and said, listen to this, it's probably going to be good.
Steve Lacy, who else was playing soprano when you started to play in the 50s?
Nobody, really. It was in complete disuse. It had gone out of a phase. Like the musicians had considered it. You know, people played it in the 20s and the 30s, and it went by the 40s. I mean, even Johnny Hodges stopped in 1942. And it, from that point on, it disappeared because it had a reputation for being out of tune, and arrangers didn't know what to do with it, and it just fell into disuse. So I think the only person that I knew of playing it was a student of Bechet's, who was Bob Wilbur, and he was playing exactly like Bechet, really, and that's all. And nobody else was playing it.
What were the pros and cons of feeling like you had the field to yourself?
Well, the advantages were many. I didn't compete with anybody. I didn't threaten anybody else's job, so that I was welcomed into all these traditional bands that I played with. My teacher, Cecil Scott, took me around and had me sit in with the likes of Red Allen, Pee Wee Russell, and all these people. And after a while, I started getting hired and working with all these original masters who were at the peak of their form, really. They were in their 50s and 60s. I was 19, 20. And that's how I cut my teeth, really. I learned from playing with these people. And it was the New Orleans school and the Chicago school and the Kansas City school.
And the disadvantages?
And the disadvantages were that nobody hired me after a while.
Because they didn't know what to do with you?
Well, the traditional, yeah, I stopped playing the clarinet. See, I was working with Max Kaminsky regularly, and I was playing soprano and clarinet, and it was working very well. And I decided to concentrate only on the soprano at that point, because I think I was starting to play with Cecil Taylor also. And when I told Max I'm not going to play the clarinet anymore, he said, you're crazy. You won't get any work at all. And it was true. Those people, I stopped working with them, and I started to play with Cecil Taylor.
Let me play something that was part of your recording debut. This was made, I think it was 1954, when you were, I believe, 20 years old, in a kind of traditional jazz group led by Dick Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
And you played both clarinet and soprano in this. We'll hear you on soprano on a recording of Liza. You want to say anything about this session before we hear it?
Well, that was a young band. They called it Progressive Dixieland. It was Dick Sutton's conception, and it was influenced by Mulligan and by Bix Beiderbecke and Miles, and it was like a hybrid movement. It had some freshness to it. It was good.
An interesting concept and interesting music as well. So this is Liza with my guest Steve Lacy on soprano saxophone, recorded in 1954, his recording debut. Thank you. A 1954 recording of Liza with Steve Lacy on soprano saxophone. We'll talk more with Steve Lacy after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with soprano saxophonist and composer Steve Lacy. A couple of years after playing modern Dixieland in the mid-50s, Steve Lacy joined a group led by avant-gardist Cecil Taylor. I asked Lacy about that shift in his direction.
Well, yeah, it was a radical change, that's for sure. But Cecil had very strong traditional roots also, and we both had a shared interest in the Ellington line, and that's like a line that covers a lot of ground, really, and goes through. See, I was playing with Don Fry at Jimmy Ryan's when I met Cecil, and that was like the Ellington, James P. Johnson line, all that. That's traditional. And Cecil also comes from like Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell, and this is another tradition, but in a way they're the same. It's the same story. It's just one ocean of jazz, really, with a lot of different strains to it.
You continue to play in different styles of jazz and to pick up from different periods, and you still play free sometimes, and you play standards, and you play a lot of original compositions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think now about free improvisation? What do you like about doing it? What do you think are its limitations?
Well, it was very important to have done that, and some people are still doing that, and I do it once in a while, and it's at the heart of what we do. It depends who you're playing with. The answer is it depends who you're playing with. When I play with Derek Bailey, there's no paper, there's no words said, there's nothing to say. We just get up and play. And when I there are several other people that we play like that with. But normally I prefer a more structured situation where there is a composed part and an improvised part, and there is a form and there is a content. That is partially prepared. That's just my own metabolism. But as I say, it depends who you're playing with. The thing is, you want to get the best results out of the other players that you play with, so you have to turn them on.
Cecil Taylor took you to hear Thelonious Monk, and that, I think, really changed your music, too. When you heard Monk and became very excited by his harmonies and his rhythms, his odd rhythms, I'm wondering how you translated some of that to soprano. For example, a lot of Monk's music is based on these really unusual, interesting harmonies, very often dissonant harmonies, and you're playing a single line instrument.
Mm-hmm. I
mean, you can't make chords on a soprano saxophone. So how did you, is there a way you feel you were able to apply some of his harmonic thinking into your horn?
Well, first of all, I play the piano as a laboratory, and I learned all his tunes at the piano, really, with the, you know, with the chords and everything, with the sounds, with the intervals and the voicings as much as I could. And then working on my horn, you can't play a chord all at once, but you can delineate it. You can outline it. You can express it. There is a way to express everything on everything, if you can find it. It's a question of imagination.
Monk invited you to join his quartet, making the group a quintet for the 4 months that you were there. Do you have any idea why he asked you to join? I mean, obviously he liked what you were doing.
Well, I think he was intrigued with the sound of the horn, the novelty of it, and he found something. And also he knew me. I knew him for a few years, and I was really on his case. I was recording his music and coming to see him all the time, every night, and talking, you know. So he was familiar with me. He knew me and all that, and he knew I was really not an expert, but an aficionado of his music, and maybe he thought I needed the experience. That's what I like to think. I like to think that he gave me that opportunity to really see what was happening from the inside.
And what did you learn seeing the music from the inside? What are some things you got from actually playing with Monk and talking with him?
I learned to stick to the point and to not lose the point and not get carried away, and to play with the other musicians and not to get all wrapped up in my own thing, and not to just play interesting notes just to be interesting, you know, or weird notes just to be weird. He mostly told me what not to do. He never told me what to do, but he told me what not to do when I did something that bothered him. For example, when I played, when we were playing together, sometimes he would play something on the piano and I would pick that up and play that on my horn. I thought I was being slick, you know, and he stopped me. He said, "Don't do that. That's, you know, I'm the piano player. You play your part. I'm accompanying you. Don't pick up on my things." You know, he got me out of the thing of trying to be too hip. I was trying to be too hip, and it wasn't swinging sometimes, you know. Then he told me, make the drummer sound good, because I was playing some things that confused the drummer, because I was confused myself. And so the drummer was not swinging, you know, and Monk told me, no, make the drummer sound good. And that was an enormous help to me, really. It stopped me cold, really, and changed my focus. And Monk's thing, he told me, let things go by. Let certain things go by. Don't play everything. Just play certain things. Let other things go by. It's what you don't play that's very important, really, and that's extremely important.
A kind of intervals of laying out of the
space.
Yeah.
Space, using the space as time,
mm-hmm.
and using time and digging time as space.
You've been recording Monk compositions throughout your career, and I want to play one of the duets from a recent album called Five Facings, and it's a series of duets with five different other jazz musicians, and I want to play one of the duets that you recorded with Misha Mengelberg, a Dutch pianist who's also very influenced by Monk. Let's hear your recording of Monk's Off Minor, a duet with the Dutch pianist Misha Mengelberg. And this was recorded in 1996. It seems to me on this, it's as if you on the soprano saxophone are playing the right hand and Misha Mengelberg on piano is playing the left hand.
Well, that's, in a way, I mean, I am a melodic instrument. All I can do is a single line of melody, and Misha has all the harmonic equipment down there, the armaments. He's armed to the teeth, really. He could do all that stuff, but he's got the taste and the discretion and the knowledge of Monk to complement what I do, and we always hit it off well together.
Okay, well, this is Off Minor. Thank you. Steve Lacy and pianist Misha Mengelberg from Lacy's recent CD, Five Facings. We'll talk more with Lacy after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with composer and soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy. A few years ago, you did what kind of exercise book with a series of short essays? That elaborated some of your thinking about studying the instrument.
Yeah.
You have one exercise you call the No Baby exercise. Would you explain that for us?
Well, that comes from a piece that I wrote a long time ago. It was originally intended as a portrait of Sidney Bechet, who I imagined was talking to his girlfriend, and he was saying, "No, baby, no, baby, no, baby, no, baby," like that. And that's how that piece began, really. And then I wrote a melody to go with that, which was a sort of a blues in unusual harmonies. And we played that for years and years and recorded and everything. And the idea of the exercise coming from that is the dynamics, the way of saying something each time louder, and the way of corresponding your saxophone to your own speech.
So, in other words, learning the things we already intuitively
language.
Know about speech
about
and
language.
Applying that to the instrument.
It's about language. My fundamental thing is about language, really. I deal with language.
Mm-hmm.
The jazz is language. The saxophone is language. And a lot of the music I write is based on literature and texts and language.
You recommend trying to sing and play whatever you hear.
Yeah.
Do you sing a lot as part of your exercise?
Well, yeah, that's very important. The connection with the voice, the ear, and the saxophone is fundamental, is something I learned in Japan, actually, from a Zen master, a flute player who gave me a couple of lessons, and that was the first lesson he gave me, was the connection with the ear, the voice, and the instrument, and the breath. And that was a huge revelation for me.
What was the connection that he made clear that you hadn't thought of before?
That my own voice was my own ear, was my own breath, was my own sound, that it was all one. That in the conception that it's just one thing. It's got to be like one thing.
Now, I wonder how it feels playing a horn whose range is higher than your vocal range.
Well, that's a good question. But it's a question of the imagination and the compensation. And again, as I said before, I have a good inner ear.
Mm-hmm.
In the inner ear, is no problem of hearing much higher. I don't have to sing it outwardly, I sing it inside. So the inner mechanism is just as good as the outer one. You don't have to actually sing sometimes. You can hear it singing inside.
A few years ago, you gave up smoking after, I think, about 30 years of a pack a day.
Yeah, that's right.
Are you still not smoking?
That's right. Yeah, no, I never went back to them.
Was there a kind of breaking point for you where you thought, like, I can't do this anymore?
That's right. It was, well, actually, that same lesson from this Japanese, who I might as well name, Watazumi Doso, who died a few years ago. He was the absolute master of a shakuhachi flute. And that was part of the first lesson that he gave me. He said, stop smoking, you know. But that was 1976, I think. And I didn't stop smoking for 5 more years.
Oh, but so it's been a long time that you haven't been smoking.
Oh, yes, it's been about 15 years.
Oh. And did you use any technique, or did you realize the importance of stopping so much that you were just able to do it on your own?
I had a good time stopping. I didn't find it difficult. I found it fun, and it made me very nervous. And I sort of had the heebie-jeebies for a while, but I enjoyed them because at least it was new. I like, you know, I strive for some kind of freshness, some kind of quality of newness, and even in life, too. And there was a situation where I stopped smoking all of a sudden, and it was a shock. It was weird. It made me nervous. It made me... but I was in a hotel room. I had a couple of days off on a tour I was at, and I decided not to start. I didn't stop smoking. I couldn't stop smoking, but I could not start. I just kept delaying. I didn't buy any, and I just stayed in a hotel room and had the heebie-jeebies for a while. And I enjoyed that, you know. And then the whole day went by, and I said, wow. Phew. And I went to sleep, and I woke up the next morning, and I said, wow, you know. And it was very, I didn't find it difficult. I found it fun, really.
Steve Lacy is currently on an American tour that will take him through Buffalo, Los Angeles, Portland, Seattle, and Cambridge. His latest CDs are Baya and Five Facings. We'll close with a forthcoming CD of Lacy's new opera, The Cry, which will be released next year on Black Saint Records. The text is by the exiled poet from Bangladesh, Tanzleeman Nasreen. The singer is Lacy's wife and longtime collaborator, Irene Abey. I'm Terry Gross. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Clint Eastwood. He directed the new movie Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, based on the best-selling novel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.